Domestic violence in Maine. An exhibit currently on display at the Holocaust and Human Rights Center of Maine calls attention to the stories of women who have been abused by their partners. The photojournalist behind the exhibit is one of those women, Patricia McLean. Her story made headlines in large part because of her name. Her ex-husband is the singer Don McLean. The exhibit illustrates that domestic violence affects every socioeconomic group. According to the Maine Coalition to End Domestic Violence, one in four women and one in seven men has experienced severe physical violence by an intimate partner in their lifetime. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we'll examine the myths and realities of domestic violence in Maine, learn about initiatives to end it, and resources to help those in danger. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Domestic violence takes on many forms and is all too prevalent here in Maine and nationwide. Local organizations are working to bring greater awareness to this problem and offer support and help to those who are in abusive relationships. Joining me in the studio, Francine Garland Stark is Executive Director of the Maine Coalition to End Domestic Violence. Jeff Trafton is Waldo County Sheriff, whose work has focused on domestic violence issues. And Shira Burns is Assistant District Attorney for York County. As always, we want to hear from you. Are you concerned about somebody close to you in a potentially abusive situation? Do you have suggestions for ways to get help? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Francine, I was on the website for the coalition, Maine Coalition to End Domestic Violence, and I saw the statistics that one in four women and one in seven men will be the victim of a severe physical attack in their life. And those numbers just seem so high and so hard to get one's head around, especially because there's been such awareness in our lifetimes about domestic violence. Why are those, first of all, how does one come up with those numbers? Why are they so high? And why does it feel like they haven't budged?
Well, that's a lot of questions all at once. I think that those numbers are real. They're recreated from in a variety of ways, different research approaches. The Center for Disease Control has done research. A number of really reputable organizations have recreated those. And so we know that these rates are real. We know that in Maine, the organizations that are part of the Maine Coalition to End Domestic Violence serve over 14,000 people a year just in our state. And those are just the folks calling out for help. And so I think that, you know, for me, I'm a very sort of positive focused person. And I like to remind people that prior to 1973, there wasn't any place to call for help in our state. Spruce Run, now Partners for Peace in Bangor, was the third such organization in the country. And it was founded here in Maine. So this is in many ways a very young movement that has made incredible progress. And so we should be a little bit patient with ourselves, but impatient for more good work to be done. And I think what we've done really well is to create systems for people who are victims of domestic abuse and violence to know where they can reach out for help and to really begin to change the way the community understands these issues. But there hasn't been nearly enough focus on accountability for people who believe they have the right to treat others in this really harmful way. And so we have to really work hard at the issue of prevention and more effective and earlier interventions to really change the way all of us perceive what does it mean to be in right relationship and how are we allowed to treat each other and what can we expect of each other, especially in intimate relationships.
Shira, what kind of cases are you seeing as a prosecutor?
So I prosecute only domestic violence and sexual assault cases, and from misdemeanors to our felonies. And we see the gamut. And when we think about domestic violence, I think a lot of the public has a certain feeling of what is domestic violence, when really it's a lot broader than that. But we do what people call just pushes. prosecute that. That's a domestic violence assault, all the way to when victims end up in the hospital. One of the most prevalent ways we see domestic violence being committed now is by strangulation. That, to me, we're in an epidemic of, and I'm going to say men usually, because even though domestic violence is usually committed by men, strangulation is almost always committed by men, of men strangling women. And luckily, we do have a statute in place that makes strangulation a Class B felony, which is our second tier of felonies.
Are cases difficult to prosecute? Are they difficult to prove?
Domestic violence cases are one of the hardest cases to prove. I talk to my fellow prosecutors all the time, and we talk about their Walmart cases, their Walmart theft cases that are on video. We don't have cases that are on video in domestic violence. And so usually my proof is what a victim is telling her story. And unfortunately, in domestic violence cases, about 90% of my victims will recant or not want to cooperate in prosecution. So the evidence I'm left with is usually very minimal. And then when we have juries, when we do have victims that want to cooperate and tell their stories, even though domestic violence is widely publicized, our public thinks a domestic violence victim should act a certain way. So as soon as a victim gets on the stand and she talks about how she stayed with the abuser for so long after this, our juries usually won't believe. That will be the reason to discredit her, because in their minds, victims wouldn't have done that. So she must not be telling the truth.
Sheriff Trafton, I asked Shira how difficult they are to prosecute, how difficult to investigate.
Well, each case is different, but some are very easy because there'll be a lot of physical evidence. We have to use everything. We try to use what we call evidence-based prosecution-type cases, investigations. So, like I said, in many cases, you have property damage. You have smashed furniture, smashed dishes. Many cases, you'll have injuries that they can't hide, you know, that the abuser can't hide. Again, you'll have the 911 tape that we use those for evidence. In Waldo County, the deputies all wear body cameras. So during the whole interaction, they're recording. So we get almost a real-time statement from the victim. And then oftentimes the perpetrator, which is most often male, will make admissions, his demeanor, everything. We use everything we can gather to make that case possible and successful in court.
In Waldo County, you started a domestic violence task force. Why did you do that?
Well, we had one many years ago, and it just, for a lot of different reasons, it kind of faded away. So I worked with our victim witness advocate. I worked with Ellie Hutchinson from New Hope for Women, and we decided it was time to bring it back so that we could be more successful. And we all put our heads together, and everybody has a part in the prosecution, working with the victim, providing services to victims and families. And New Hope always comes to mind because they really help us as police provide services to victims and victims' families to help them break away, help them have a couple of days after an assault to you know, where we can help provide, you know, maybe it's diapers, maybe it's formula, safe place to stay, safety planning, all of those things to help a victim feel safe and realize after maybe a day or two, I can leave this, I can get away from this. It can happen. And
this issue is personal for you, isn't it?
Yes, very.
Why?
I grew up in a house with domestic violence.
I'm sorry to hear that. Do you believe that Waldo County has been able to make significant progress since the task force started?
Well, like Francine said earlier, the numbers are strong, and every year we keep hoping for a reduction, and it never happens. We, just in Waldo County, the law enforcement agencies I work with, we respond between 300 and 400 calls a year, every year. So sometimes we don't try to measure our success in how many calls that we actually investigate, but, you know, well, backing up a little bit, we did a grant to get a domestic violence detective position at the sheriff's office a few years ago. And as we were writing the grant, one of the things the STOP grant wanted was, how do we measure our success? And for the whole 3 years we had that grant, we struggled with that. How do we measure success? So I think we have to measure it one victim at a time, because every case is different, every victim is different, every situation is different. And if we, it doesn't necessarily have to be a successful prosecution for that to be a successful case. If we can convince a victim to move away, or get away from her abuser, realize that she can have a new life without being abused, the children can, if she has children, she can have a better life, all that stuff is possible. And if we can move someone in that direction, we see it as a win.
Francine, I want to come back to you and talk about people who may be listening right now and may be in an abusive situation. Many, as Jeff was referring to, alluding to, are more afraid to leave than they are afraid to stay. How do you reach those people? What do you want to say to them?
I think that there are several things. One is to remember the hotline number. The statewide hotline number is...
You can give it out, and we'll also post it on our webpage. Go ahead.
Wonderful. It's 1-866-834-4357. And you can also go to mcedv.org, and you'll click on the Get Help button, and it will take you to the local hotline numbers for the local domestic violence resource centers and the 5 Wabanaki Women's Coalition tribal-specific domestic violence and sexual assault programs. And I have two sides of a coin I want to speak about. And one is that it's so important for us to understand that while ultimately we want to make it possible for a victim of domestic abuse and violence to be able to live separately from the person abusing them, that's sometimes not possible for an array of reasons. Especially if they're older, and this is a very long-standing relationship. But even if a person leaves, as long as the person who is causing the harm believes that they have the right to and are determined to have control over that person and perhaps the children that they've had with that person, the abuse will continue in different forms. And so the leaving in and of itself is not what helps people be safe. And so what we do in our work is to really work with all of our partners in the community, but especially centered on this particular person's experience, to strategize for how they are most likely to be able to be safe. And leaving is a piece of that, but it is not the cause of their eventually being safe. The cause of their being safe is when we are able to interfere with the abuser's ability to continue to have the access to and belief and ability to act with impunity against that person and those children. And that's the kind of thing that is really hardest to do and requires all of us to find our role in that as family members and colleagues and coworkers, as well as community officials like Jeff and Shira, because so much of domestic abuse and violence never comes to the attention of the criminal justice system, because people are just trying to be safe without causing anybody any kind of harm.
Mm. Joining us on the line now is Patricia McLean. She is a photojournalist and domestic abuse survivor. Patricia, thanks for calling in.
Yes, and thank you for having the show.
Your experience with domestic violence was prominently covered in the news because your ex-husband was the well-known singer Don McLean. He eventually pleaded guilty to domestic violence in 2016. Patricia, you were married a long time. How did you finally decide to seek help?
I think that if he had not been arrested, I would either be still in the marriage or I would be dead, because I didn't really think of myself as a domestic abuse victim. To me, even though there was 29 years of abuse, which included rape and strangulation and a lot of emotional abuse, to me, a domestic abuse victim was a woman who was poor and who had a black eye. And we had 4 houses, and I never had a black eye. So I think what happened was when he was arrested, and that was made so public, I somehow ended up calling a domestic abuse agency, first in New York, where I was visiting family, and then New Hope, and I spoke with Hannah at New Hope. And that started the process of really like lifting the veil from my eyes and making me realize what I had been in all that time. I went to a support group in Bangor at a domestic abuse agency, and that was really helpful to see. We were all, like, I wouldn't have thought I could relate to any of these women who were in the room, but they nodded when I told my story. I nodded when they told their story. And that's when it was really just connecting with the domestic abuse agencies and recognizing the dynamic, you know, what I had been through. And I think that's what it was, really.
Patricia, you've channeled your energies into raising awareness and have created an exhibit that is now at the Holocaust and Human Rights Center in Augusta. I understand it's headed to Portland next and has already been in some other venues in Maine. Describe the exhibit you created.
Well, the idea for it, I am a photojournalist, and with the arrest and everything so public, a woman all around me started coming up and sharing their stories, how they had experienced domestic abuse also. And they, most of the times they would whisper it because they were ashamed. How could this have happened to me? How could I have let this happen? But soon there were a number of women. I just had this idea that we've got to break the silence around this so that everybody is aware of how much, not just me, but now that I see this, because people are telling me that everyone needs to know how much of this there is, and also the commonality. So right now we're 19 women, and there's a portrait of the woman. I ask for them to think of a place for the portrait that that is meaningful either to the abuse or their journey out of it. And then there's a power and control wheel. Each woman gets a power and control wheel, and they customize it. And then there's audio, which is really important because it's all about breaking the silence, finding our voices. And someone can walk into the exhibit. They can look at the portrait. They can look at all the power and control wheels around the room and see all the things that are similar and also the details that make everyone a little different. And then they can listen to the woman's telling through their cell phone. They dial up a number, and they can hear the woman telling their story to while you're watching, while you're looking at the portrait.
Mm. What is your message to others who are victims of domestic abuse?
My message is it's never too late. And I do appreciate what Francine is saying, and I do understand that. I feel that, but if you just get help, call your domestic abuse agency, and if you are able to safely leave, because it's not going to get better, and it's dangerous, and there's a great life ahead of you. It's going to be hard to leave, but there's a great life ahead of you once you're on the other side of it. And there's help out there, and the Maine Coalition to End Domestic Violence, all the agencies there are wonderful, and they're there to help you.
Patricia, thank you so much for calling in. Patricia McLean, a photojournalist and survivor. Her exhibit is on display now at the Holocaust and Human Rights Center of Maine. I wanted to ask, before we go quickly to a break, what Patricia said, that she didn't consider herself a victim. Is that common?
Sure. I mean, most people don't wake up in the morning and think about their life and think, what are all the things that are wrong with my life? You know, it's, we get through our days, we kind of solve one problem at a time, and we get through each piece and look to the next piece. And so one of the important things that a person can get out of calling a domestic abuse hotline is having someone to talk about your life to who can reflect that back to you, because sometimes it's like having a movie played back to you of your life. I've had many people that I've talked to over the years say, you know, I didn't realize it was so bad until I heard you summarize it back to me, and it sounds awful. And so it's just really helpful to have somebody else to talk to. These things thrive in silence.
All right. Well, we're talking about domestic violence today on Maine Calling. The phone number 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from the UMaine New Writing Series. Sponsor of Maine Public's Poems From Here, heard Fridays on Maine Public Radio and Maine Public Classical. And Local 188, celebrating 20 years of Spanish cuisine in Portland's West End neighborhood, and at local188.com.
On the next Fresh Air, the whistleblower who exposed Cambridge Analytica's role in the 2016 presidential election. The company harvested personal data from tens of millions of Facebook users and used it to target people susceptible to disinformation and conspiracy theories. Wiley had been the research director at the company. Now he's written a new book. Join us.
Join us this evening at 7 here on Maine Public Radio. Did you know that there is a 24/7 classical music station that reaches many areas of Maine? It's called Maine Public Classical. There are 7 over-the-air FM stations in Portland, Bangor, Waterville, Boothbay, Brunswick, Millbridge Down East, Fryeburg-Bridgeton, and York County. Depending on Hills and your receiver setup, you may find that Maine Public Classical can be another choice for you on the FM radio dial. Maine Public Classical, how to find it and listen to it, is online at mainepublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we're learning about domestic violence and how to get help. Joining me, Jeff Trafton, Sheriff of Waldo County. Shira Burns, Assistant District Attorney for York County. Francine Garland Stark, Executive Director of the Maine Coalition to End Domestic Violence. We invite you to join the conversation. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. I'm going to start with a Facebook post. This is from Jen. She writes, "My stepson was sentenced to 3 to 5 years for assault of his girlfriend and her 15-month-old son. Got out in 2.5 years for good behavior. Within a year of release, assaulted new girlfriend in the presence of their 4-month-old, sentenced to 2 years only. This is a problem. It seems that violent offenders in Maine only get stiff sentences if their victim dies." Shira, do you believe the sentences are too lax in Maine?
I think what we have, first of all, that sentence, it wouldn't be a Maine sentence because we don't have a 3 to 5 years. We're an actual state that has a specific sentence. So that must be from out of state. But in Maine, we do have the opportunity for long sentences. But the reality of it is these cases, we try to come to a plea when defense attorney and the prosecutor come to an agreement, and then we ask the judge to take the agreement. And usually they are light is because it's hard to prove these cases. So the prosecutor has a choice. Do I take this to trial where a victim's going to have to take the stand? She's going to get cross-examined. Her whole past is going to be brought up. And there's a chance we get a not guilty verdict and he walks free, or take a plea agreement where it's going to be a lighter sentence than what he deserves, than what we know what the victim went through. So it's a balancing act. Now, the cases that do go to trial and they're found guilty, we can get great sentences. I had a strangulation case. He was found guilty of strangulation, and he got 9 years straight time, meaning he's serving 9 years for that one count of strangulation. But again, the victim had to go through a lot to testify.
Sheriff, do you see a lot of what this Facebook poster Jen was talking about, where you have someone who spends a couple years in jail and gets out and does it again?
Yes. We see that all too often. And I think we're making some progress in that. But one thing I do have to say is I see this a lot with police officers over my career who get very frustrated with the system. And when they see short sentences or people being released early, things of that sort. So it's refreshing to hear Shyla explain very well why those short sentences happen or those plea bargains. But again, it can be very frustrating because we do see victims who are not happy with the sentence. But at the same time, if a plea bargain is made, then it helps that victim doesn't have to get up on the stand. They don't have to feel... being cross-examined by a defense attorney is a trying experience, even as a police officer, and I'm with a 35-year career, so I can't imagine a victim having to get up and talk about those personal issues on the stand. So, unfortunately, the price we pay for that would be short sentences.
Well, joining us on the line now is Lisa Marchese. She is Deputy Attorney General and Chief of the Criminal Division for the state of Maine. Thanks for calling in, Lisa.
Thank you, Jennifer, and I want to thank you and all the panel for bringing light to this important subject.
Lisa, some of the most extreme cases of domestic violence involve homicide, which falls under your area. What are some of the significant findings of the state review panel that you chair?
Sure. Let me first begin by saying the Domestic Abuse Homicide Review Panel has been in existence since 1997. And if people are interested, they can look on the Attorney General's website and see all 12 of our reports that they may find useful. But we've had a couple of reoccurring themes. I think one of the most important reoccurring theme to pay attention to is Francine spoke about victims, but a lot of times you have bystanders wondering what they can do to help. And the panel has repeatedly recommended that bystanders call local domestic violence resource centers just to get an understanding about how they can support a victim or hold a perpetrator accountable when there's risk of domestic violence. And the panel has also repeatedly suggested that if you've got a friend, a family member, a coworker, or a neighbor who hears or observes signs of danger, that they should call 911, and they shouldn't be afraid to call 911. We've reviewed so many cases in which we hear the family member or the neighbor say, "I knew he was going to kill her," and then they feel so guilty. And if they had done something when they heard what was going on, then perhaps a life would have been saved. Another common recommendation that we see is to take suicidal threats and homicidal threats very seriously.
Lisa, has there been any progress? I mean, since 1997, that's 22 years.
Right. There's no way to measure success in this particular area. I think Francine's also on the panel, and I think she can attest to that. Some years, as you may know, or as your listeners may know, 50% of all homicides in the state of Maine are generally domestic violence related. This year, that number tends to be down, but we don't know what actions or recommendations are actually saving lives. So I prefer to think we have actually kept the number at bay or reduced it rather than increasing it.
All right. Well, thanks so much for calling in. That's Lisa Marchese, Maine's Deputy Attorney General and Chief of the Criminal Division. We're going to go to a related email. This is from Paul. I have a dear friend who is in an emotionally and physically abusive relationship. I am a male friend, 20 years her senior. She has been the victim of abuse since very early childhood, starting with her pediatrician, and has a pattern of being in abusive relationships. She's in her late 30s with two children. She's also in recovery from alcoholism. In our friendship, I've tried to provide a safe and nurturing environment free of obligation and judgment, but she finds that to be very unsafe. She has been lured into false security only to be abused, so I understand that piece. My question, as a male friend, are these. Are there ways for me to be supportive and nurturing without seeming like a threat? And two, what resources are available in the Portland area for her to be able to talk to someone who can help her navigate through this pattern? I worry for her life and feel completely helpless. Francine, this is exactly what Lisa was just talking about, isn't it?
Well, it is. And of course, in the Portland area, the Domestic Violence Resource Center is called Through These Doors. And you can reach Through These Doors by going to their website and calling their 24-hour hotline. I think that would be helpful for this caller to be able to call himself and talk with someone there more thoroughly about what the relationship is and how he might think about that. And also for his friend to be able to call Through These Doors and know that some of the important components of calling for help is that all of that we do is confidential. It can be anonymous if you don't want to share your name. We are going to engage in thinking about how your life is, how you hope it could be, and think about options that you may or may not know about. And we can really help people think about what kind of possibilities exist. And there are support groups. Through These Doors has an array of support groups. They're offering one right now, actually, in Spanish. Both facilitators are fluent in Spanish. They have other kinds of culturally specific groups that they're running. And groups are a really excellent way to meet other people and help appreciate that, sadly, people who experience domestic abuse and violence and the lifetime of abuse that this friend has seemed to experience are not alone. Sadly, this is experienced by many, many people. And when they meet each other and break down that isolation, the solidarity and strength they find in each other is really very powerful.
It looked to me like you wanted to add something, Sheriff.
Well, I agree with Francine. Every case is very, very different. Everybody's situation is very different. And I think if this lady's friend can just continue to be there for her, that's huge. But at the same time, I would recommend talking with the victim about what she's comfortable with, because whatever we do, if the victim is not comfortable with moving forward, then it ended up being a negative. And So I think it's very important to talk with victims, find out what they're comfortable with, what they feel safe with, because sometimes I've seen it many times in my law enforcement career, if we push too far to try and get somebody arrested or bring charges, we actually could put a victim in more danger. And they have to be comfortable. They know what they can do, what their safety level is, and we need to respect that and work with them on that.
We'll go to Cheryl calling from Portland. Hi, Cheryl. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to advise the panel. I'm sure they may already know about this, but I was told one day by a lovely lady named Tawny. She said, Cheryl, we've had to go. Me and my organization have been invited, actually, to go into the Portland public high schools with a program that assists young ladies, especially, to be able to identify the symptoms of abuse in order to, in other words, to identify what abusive behavior looks like. And one day she told me, she said, Cheryl, we've actually been invited to go into the middle schools because we find that this abuse oftentimes starts in childhood. And then the ladies, when they grow up, they're left with absolutely no coping skills and with the sense that they have to solve these problems or believe that, you know, abuse is not really prevalent in the wider society. And I know this from personal experience also.
Cheryl, thank you for calling. Francine, is this a program you're familiar with?
All the domestic violence resource centers have prevention programs that they bring into the schools, high school, and some are in elementary schools as well as middle schools. And I think that these programs are very important, and they focus both on some of the ways to recognize when things are going wrong, but most importantly, the focus is really on how do we treat each other well, and how is it that we have respectful relationships that are fun and filled with joy, as opposed to entering relationship with this idea that someone in a relationship has the right to have control over the other person.
I'm glad you said that, because it seems as though the focus, what she was talking about, is how young women can recognize that someone might abuse them, instead of how are we reaching the potential abusers? How are we changing? Clearly, there's something going on in our society in which people believe it's okay to exert violence and power. And one in four women is an enormous amount of men who feel as though they have this right and this is normal.
It's true. And every time I say, listen, we heard from over 14,000 people last year, that means that over 14,000 people, mostly men, believe they had the right to hold their partner in a state of fear and submission in their relationship, and that's absolutely wrong. So the edge that we have to be moving on is how do we better intervene with what we all think about as what's right and wrong in our intimate relationships. It's absolutely the work that we have to do. And there are an array of new sorts of initiative to try to address that. One of the things that we're doing is trying to increase the accessibility and quality of certified batter intervention programs in our state, and to better integrate those with the larger interventions of the criminal justice system, and also encourage people who may find themselves acting abusively in their relationships who would like to have the opportunity to talk with someone about how to change the way they're behaving. They can go to these programs. They are available.
And that's what I was going to ask you, Shira. You're mentioning plea agreements. Is part of these plea agreements some significant and meaningful therapy or help for the person who's been accused or been found guilty?
Yes, almost always. And actually, Maine has been progressive. There was a new law that was passed that if you are found guilty of a domestic violence crime, that you're to attend the Certified Batterers Intervention Program. In the state of Maine, it's about a 48-week program. They have to attend once a week. It does cost a fee. And it's a group, let's say, if the offender is male, you sit in a group of about 15 other males and talk about how you battered your significant other, and then about other ways to cope. What we have seen in the Domestic Violence Homicide Review Panel has really pushed out is that anger management is not appropriate in these situations. Mental health counseling is not appropriate what's really not appropriate is marriage counseling. And those are things that the courts use to.
So you're saying when you say not appropriate, you say it doesn't work.
Correct. It's what and what the Domestic Violence Homicide Review Panel has said is not only does it not work, but it gives victims or people around them a false sense that he's getting help that is actually not helping him whatsoever.
So anger management help doesn't work.
Anger management.
Therapy, marriage counseling doesn't work.
Correct. And actually anger management, if you think about what's anger management is batterers actually can control their anger better than anyone. So an officer shows up on the scene. This male has just beat his victim, and then he comes, and the officer's there, and he's acting like, what? Nothing happened. And he's so polite. He actually can control his what
so
we call
anger.
So
what does work?
And what we've shown, what the studies have seen, is that the best option is the Certified Batterers Intervention Program. So if someone is found guilty of domestic violence, they are ordered to go to this 48-week program. And I'm not going to say it works in every circumstance. We have this thing called an ODARA score we do in the state of Maine, and it's a risk assessment. Every law enforcement officer, when they respond, have to come up with an ODARA score. And we're trying to look at the correlation between an ODARA score, meaning how likely is this person going to reoffend, with the success rate of the Certified Batterers Intervention Program. So this is all new stuff that we have to keep studying to see, you know, when we talk about success rate, are we seeing a difference in these people's behaviors?
We do need to take another quick break. When we come back, more of your questions and comments about domestic violence in Maine. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Paris Auto Barn, committed to an eco-friendly business model and specializing in the sales and service of hybrid and electric vehicles. ParisAutoBarn.com. And the law offices of Joe Bornstein, Maine lawyers committed to working for Maine people since 1974. Learn more at JoeBornstein.com. This afternoon at 2, Maine Public Radio will broadcast a primary 2020 special, a candidate forum from The Exchange from our friends at New Hampshire Public Radio. Featured is a conversation with former Republican Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld, who is campaigning for the Republican presidential nomination. That's coming up in about 15 minutes today at 2 here on Maine Public Radio. From bookstores to banks, restaurants to realtors, Maine Public Radio is supported by a wide variety of businesses and organizations. They understand the importance of Maine Public in our community, and their investment helps make this service possible. More information about business support is available at mainepublic.org. Click on support or give us a call at 800-884-1717 and ask for Susan Tran. Together, we make Maine Public Radio and Classical possible.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, dealing with domestic violence. Joining me, Shira Burns, Assistant District Attorney for York County. Francine Garland Stark with the Maine Coalition to End Domestic Violence. And Jeff Trafton, who is Waldo County Sheriff. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. 1-800-399-3566. One thing I know, Francine, you want to make clear is that you don't have to have bruises for this to be domestic violence.
Absolutely not. I think it's one of the things that breaks my heart the most is when I hear people say, do you still help folks even if they've never been hit? And there are so many ways that this coercive controlling behavior is shaped. And so I want people to, when they're thinking about what's happening in their lives, to recognize that if someone is controlling who you see, who you talk to, what you wear, whether you go to school, whether or not you have children, whether or not you have access to the money, whether or not you get to pursue a career that you want to pursue, all of these things are forms of abuse that's part of this pattern of coercive controlling behavior over the course of time that you wake up one morning and realize, my goodness, I don't even recognize myself anymore. I've changed so much in what I do and what I think and how I feel about myself. That, too, is domestic abuse and violence. It's insidious and it's hard, and many of those things are truly not even against the law. But we help people like that every day through our network, so I encourage those folks to call the hotline and talk with someone.
All right, and again, the hotline number 1-866-834-4357, correct?
Correct.
And that'll be on our website and Facebook page. We'll go to Tricia, who's calling from Mount Vernon. Hi, Tricia. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, thank you for having this program. I'm a survivor of domestic abuse from many years ago. My point is that I find that when I go to a doctor's office, an appointment, or to the ER in particular, my husband usually accompanies me when I go into the room a lot of times. And I know that abusers like to do that because they don't want their partner to say anything wrong. But I'm asked, in the company of my husband, do you feel safe at home? A person who's being abused is not going to say no when their abuser is sitting right there. They're going to say yes. And I don't know if it's just a law or a series of questions that they have to ask. But in most cases, a person is not going to accuse their abuser in front of a stranger in a medical office or in an emergency department situation.
Sure, Tricia. Thank you. It seems as though, to me, Francine, best practice ought to be that a person is separated from the person who comes in with them to the doctor's office or the ER.
It's true, but I really appreciate Tricia's call very much because I hear this all the time. Every time we bring up the issue of the healthcare system, there's someone in the room who will tell that almost an identical story. And so one of the things that actually that we're doing at the Maine Coalition to End Domestic Violence in the coming year, with some additional funding from the state of Maine, is to really pull together folks to do a significant amount of outreach across the state to the healthcare system to see what we can do to really make some important changes in how the healthcare system is understanding these issues and the context in which they're doing this very important work of trying to ask and understand people's circumstances at home. But clearly, if you're not doing this, when the person is alone in the room with privacy, you can't get an authentic response. And that just leads to all sorts of other problems subsequently.
Tricia, thank you so much for calling in this hour with this very important point. We're going to move on to Mary Ann calling from South Portland. Hi, Mary Ann. Go ahead.
Hi, just a second. I have to hear you. I'm calling about the protective orders that might be filed against an abuser that when I've looked at what happens in other states, at least, the first time the abuser violates the protective order, maybe he's given a warning, and that's about it. And it just gets him angry, and he's free to keep harassing the woman, stalking her, not just at home, but at the workplace.
All right. So what is your question, Marianne, what happens in Maine if someone has a protective breaks a protection from abuse order? I'll ask the sheriff, is someone arrested if they break it?
Almost always there will be an arrest. In Maine, we have a mandatory arrest law. And protection orders, there has to be a certain level of investigation done just to make sure that it's a valid complaint. But if it turns out to be a valid complaint, that's a mandatory arrest, and they will be arrested in Maine.
All right. So there you go, Mary
Ann. And just this year, we passed the law raising the third offense to be prosecuted as a felony. That's a brand new law that just took effect in the state of Maine.
And we take protection orders so seriously that if you're arrested for a violation of protection from abuse order, a bail commissioner cannot set bail for that defendant. They have to wait until they go in front of a judge, and only a judge can set bail. So the defendant will not be released until he goes in front of a judge.
Thank you, Mary Ann, for that question. We'll go to Patty, who's calling from Bangor. Hi, Patty. Go ahead.
Hi. In following up with that, my concern is, where is the technology at this point? Because we have those ankle bracelets that can be put on people to be monitoring as like where they are. And is there a possibility that some technology might be coming down the line so that when somebody has a protective order, could an ankle bracelet be used for the perpetrator, and maybe an alarm system given to the victim so that when that person is in the area, that victim has a chance to get away?
Sure. I'm really glad that you brought this up because Sheriff Chafton, you're doing something like that in Waldo County, aren't you?
Yes, we currently have a program just like that in Waldo County. Several counties are using it now. It's an ankle monitor. It's a satellite tracking, and it marries up with a cell phone service. and it does a very good job of showing us it in real time where that abuser is. So we can set whole towns where this person cannot go, if say the victim's hometown. And the, you also mentioned an alarm for the victim, and we do have proximity alarms for the victim. So if a victim is, say, shopping at the Portland Mall, and her abuser, he may be not anywhere near, he has no way of knowing she might be there, but if he comes within a certain distance, and that's adjustable to her, her alarm will go off, he won't even know, and it gives her the chance to leave the area and stay safe. So that technology exists and is currently in use.
Patty, thanks for the question. Rachel on Facebook says, I work for a social services agency. Oftentimes, I find that the root causes of physical or emotional abuse, as well as alcohol abuse and many other personal issues, have root causes outside of the family. I feel that domestic violence, at least in part, is as well. What can we do as a society to prevent domestic violence, specifically language that makes women and children easy targets of violence? Francine.
Well, I think there's just, you know, sometimes I say, you know, the opportunity to make a difference is available to us in every second. And everything that we challenge, everything we say, everything we expect of each other. And so I think it's really important for us to take this as seriously as we do. But I think that we need to create, need to look at our homes, every place our children are in childcare, our schools, our sports teams, every place that young people are is an opportunity for them to feel honored, respected as a person, and to have expectations on them about the way they should treat other people. And we should take all of that seriously and not presume that, well, that's just kids being kids, but wrong behavior is wrong behavior at any age. And the way we're taught to appreciate each other and respect each other, regardless of your identity or gender or anything, is at the root cause of what is going on in these situations where one person believes they have the right to have control and intimidate and treat another badly, up to and including taking their life. So it's on all of us.
All right. So many good callers coming in and so little time left. Shenna Bellows from the Holocaust and Human Rights Center. Hi, Shenna. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. I just wanted to say this is such an important conversation. Thank you for hosting it. And for those listeners who want to hear and learn more, Sheriff Trafton, Patricia McLean, and three other survivors will be speaking on a panel, What Trapped Me, What Freed Me, this Thursday, the 10th at 6:30 p.m. at the Holocaust and Human Rights Center.
And that's in Augusta.
That's in Augusta.
Thank you so much for calling in. Shenna Bellows from the Holocaust and Human Rights Center. We're going to go to Gail from Portsmouth. Hi, Gail. If you could ask your question quickly, that'd be great.
Sure. So I had spoken to someone who was familiar and was a police officer who dealt with these cases, and he mentioned something that seemed to make a lot of sense to me, that the low reporting rates, which I'm sure they are very low, like any female crime who's this type of crime against women in particular, is that once they come and arrest or that they the breadwinner is removed if the woman is staying at home with children, and that is a big
sure, Francine, this our finance is often a big problem in people escaping abusive relationships.
They sure are. And one of the things that, you know, we overestimate how much it is that people can simply say, well, this is a bad situation, we're just going to end it right now. And I think many people who have faced even, you know, being in a job where you felt abused or misused, you can't just walk out the next day because you've got to pay the bills, you've got obligations, you have to think about it. And so I think all of our public policy that has to do with helping people be able to be paid well, paid living wages, have access to benefits and pursue education and pursue their careers is part of what makes it possible for all people to feel like they can make the best authentic choices in the circumstances that they find themselves. And so, and not just say, oh gosh, this person who's in crisis needs to have that. We all need to have that. So all these issues are so interconnected.
Gail, thanks for your call. And quickly going to Margaret in Castine. Hi, Margaret, go ahead.
Hi. I wanted to say that I pastor a congregation in Castine, and Francine took me to school on domestic abuse 20 years ago. So thank you, Francine.
You're welcome.
And I just wanted to mention for anybody out there that's a member of a faith-based community, we have so much to offer in terms of the coordinated community response to ending domestic abuse. And our local domestic violence resource centers, they'll send anybody to a congregation. We did a special service this last Sunday on domestic abuse, and the folks from Next Step were there to help us. And it's really important that we are part of the solution and not perpetuating the secrecy of the problem.
Margaret, thank you so much for calling in from Castine and calling on the faith-based community to be part of the solution. Jeff, you know, this whole conversation has been discouraging, but you have optimism. Why?
I do. I really believe, just like with smoking, when I was a kid, everybody smoked. And today it's socially unacceptable to smoke, which is a good thing. And I think we can do the same thing with domestic violence if we all work as a community and make it plain and clear to everybody, this is not socially acceptable, and we're not going to tolerate it as a society. We can do that.
What level of, what do you foresee happening to make that happen? We just had a call from a pastor at a church, clearly one part of the solution, but what else needs to happen to get where we need to be?
Well, I think we need to be in the schools teaching young people that this is not acceptable. Violence, I think maybe less violence on TV. I think continuing to fight against bullying, because a domestic violence abuser is a true bully in every sense of the word. And we need to fight against that and, again, make it is not acceptable to be a bully. I think we can do that.
All right. Well, thank you all for being here on this program today. Again, we will be posting resources on our Facebook page and our webpage, maincalling.org. The voice you just heard, Jeff Trafton, Waldo County Sheriff. Also here with us, Shira Burns, Assistant District Attorney for York County, and Francine Garland Stark, Executive Director of the Maine Coalition to End Domestic Violence. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as helpful links and resources at maincalling.org. Today's program will be broadcast again tonight at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.